The pause, now the pitch. Chaparro swings and misses. The changeup struck him out. Ninth strikeout of the game from Tong.
24-year-old Nolan McLean.
And dad are here.
Oh, that is so cool.
Taking in the moment.
Absolutely.
And that slider in for a call, strike three. And McLean showing off his wear, strikes out the first batter he faces in the major leagues.
I'm impressed that he threw that sweep, the two sweeps for strikes. First inning, first batter.
He could have called the first pitch sinker for a strike.
Get that ball to the authenticator. Struck him out, got him with a curveball. Nolan McLean with two strikeouts in his first big league inning. Impressive start. On the inside corner, got him looking at a changeup. First time we've seen that pitch. And McLean has his third strikeout. 1-2-3 in the second. Rosarena down on strikes for the second time. Went upstairs with the fastball. That's the fourth strikeout for McLean and the first out of the inning.
What a great visit by Hefner. You're right, Gary. He went out there and just told him to be more aggressive. He was, and he finishes him off with his fastball. He's got a good fastball.
Ground ball backhanded by McLean. Out at second. Beatty the first for a double play. How did he do that? Nolan McLean going behind the back to start the 1-4-3 double play. Brilliantly done by the rookie right-hander, and he can't help cracking a smile. And a swing and a miss, got him with the curveball. Strikeout number five for Nolan McLean. Most strikeouts he had in the minor league game this year was 10. He's halfway there in his big league debut. And he strikes out Polanco on a curveball to end the inning.
It's just one of those things since he's a kid. I bet you he's had a good curveball.
1-0 Mets in the fourth. And he struck him out, back foot curveball. Strikeout number seven for Nolan McLean. Two down.
Alvarez called for it down. He throws it down. Perfect placement.
1-2 coming. Tried to dot the outside corner and got it there for strike three. Beautiful pitch. Number eight for McLean. One down in the sixth.
That to me was the best pitch he threw all day. He set up an all-star player.
Well, you hear the boos because Carlos Mendoza is coming out to take Nolan McLean out of the game. After 5 1/3 innings and 91 pitches, a brilliant opening effort by the 24-year-old from North Carolina. And he will exit with a 1-0 lead. And nothing but positive feelings for Nolan McLean.
Have an afternoon like this for you.
Surreal. I mean, I couldn't have dreamed it up.
Have an afternoon like this for you.
Surreal. I mean, I couldn't have dreamed it up any better. From the fans to getting out there and being able to compete against a good Seattle team.
It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Sunday, August the 17th, 2025. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X at TalkingMetsNOG and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. No G, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. You can get me on Instagram, TalkingMetsNOG, and don't forget the newsletter, substack.com/@TalkingMetsNOG. Welcome to another edition of the Talking Mets podcast. I come to you here on a Sunday morning. Mets playing tonight, playing the Mariners in the Little League Classic in Williamsport. Has been a few years since the Mets have been part of that. That should be a fun night. Figured I'd come to you after a tremendously fulfilling, maybe transformative day in this era of Mets baseball. Talk a little bit about that. Obviously react a few days later to the Pete Alonso home run record and a little bit about the future of Pete here. And then, you know, with all that's going on with the team, I thought, you know, let's just go into Sunday night game and kind of put this stuff on the table, especially because of the start by McLean. But wanted to start off with a quick, short announcement for all of you. Nothing bad, actually. I think it'll be good. So you didn't hear any commercials coming in. And I know one of the things and one of the pieces of feedback that I've been getting over the years is people just don't like commercials. So when I created the newsletter for the premium content, one of the things I put in there was, hey, you know, you can listen to the show commercial free. And then as time went on and I was thinking about it, I think that, you know, this thing we do here is really split into two. You have your hardcore fans, listeners that want to really engage, and you have your, those that, and it's not a criticism, that just want to do the podcast. So I said, you know what, maybe it's time, and myself and fans sided, you know, parted ways, mutually parted ways, no hard feelings there. They were great partners for almost 4 years. And from now on, the podcast will be commercial free. You won't have to worry about any interruptions at all, whether you're a paid or free subscriber. And we'll amp up the premium content. You saw this week, we amped it up a little bit. It'll be written. It could be video. It could be audio. It depends on, honestly, my mood, the topic, a bunch of things. And I hope that those that continue to subscribe and get the premium content will enjoy it. We'll do some fun things. Maybe we'll add some premium interviews outside of the flow of the day-to-day comings and goings of Mets baseball, which is really what the Sunday show is all about. There'll be something for everybody. This is a big tent. I want everybody to have something, whether you want to just listen on Sunday, whether you want to dive deeper into it. So I hope this kind of cleans up a little bit of what, I guess, was some choppiness to the product, which has evolved over the last 5 years, has started to get some monetization. And like I said, the monetization really is to put back into the show to make sure that I'm able to, you know, provide you with the best sound, with, you know, the ability to, you know, do some things when it comes to subscription services of my own, whether it be Baseball Reference or MLB TV, that I could just invest back into the show. Nothing over here is, you know, getting me on a yacht to some exotic island. But enough of that. You didn't tune in to hear about that. I just wanted to make sure you guys understood what you're hearing and seeing. It's already kind of been in play over the last week, as you saw the amping up of the premium content. Hopefully those who are paid subscribers enjoy it. If you're not a paid subscriber, no problem. You want to try it on a free trial, have at it. We're going to be as fair and equitable to those that pay, fair and equitable to those that prefer not to. You know, there's something for everybody. And I want everybody to feel fulfilled with whatever way they want to consume this show. So new era in Talking Mets, on to the new. And look, let's start here, because yesterday was an extremely big day in Mets history. It may go down as a big day in Mets history. And it reminded me that, you know, of a night not too long ago, maybe 13 years ago, in the Arizona desert in the middle of the night, where, you know, Matt Harvey made his debut. And unlike today, where I think, and prospects were talked about in 2012. Don't get me wrong. I knew about Matt Harvey. We followed Matt Harvey throughout his minor league career, but not to the level it is now. Not to the level where you have these different prospect boards and, you know, shows dedicated to it and video. I mean, X has created so much video where you don't just read about what these guys are doing. You see their stuff. You see highlights. Maybe not. And you can even watch their whole starts. I mean, you know, SNY on Mets days off, you know, puts up the Syracuse Mets, or sometimes the B Mets, I know. Well, not that they're Rumble Ponies now. I always call them the B Mets. The B Mets is kind of like what I call them, all right? It's wrong. But, you know, you get to see these guys, so you're very familiar with them. So sometimes when they make it to the big leagues, there's not that same surprise. Or, you know, the night that Matt Harvey made his debut, you know, somebody who was in the stands that night, someone who had some scouting experience, you know, said, that's a Hall of Famer there. Now, Harvey didn't fulfill that potential over the long haul of a variety of reasons that, you know, are not important today. But that was a moment where things started to turn around. Now, the Mets were still in baseball purgatory, and for the most part, they'd be in that financial purgatory throughout Harvey's career and the other four aces, because you had Wheeler at that point in the organization. DeGrom, you didn't really hear much about, but he was there. Mats was starting to come. You were still a little bit away from acquiring Noah Syndergaard. So the pieces were coming together for a team that nearly won a championship based on pitching. And, you know, everybody sometimes, and I think they're starting to see, gives Sandy Alderson a lot of credit. And I'm not going to make this show about bashing Sandy Alderson. I think the big thing is those players maybe were developed under the organization of Alderson. But the real miss of the Alderson regime, and this is really the first one, by and large, was they were not able to. Maybe it was, a lot of it was infrastructure, but they really weren't able to draft. And that's Tommy Tanis, too, who has a lot to do with the next wave of players coming up. He was there during the Alderson years. But they were not really able to take what they had with those pitchers and start to develop the next wave. And if you go and just look at, since 2017, some of the top innings from pitchers in the Mets, I mean, Edwin Diaz is number 9 in innings since 2017. Taijuan Walker is number 8. I mean, you still, you know, obviously DeGrom, who's only been away a couple of years, and Zach Wheeler and Steven Matz, they were here so long. But when you start to look at, and this is post-Harvey, Syndergaard, this, you were hoping that, you know, guys like Syndergaard haven't been around in 5 years. DeGrom hasn't been around in 3. Matz hasn't been around in 5 years. Lugo was mostly a reliever, but he started early on in his career. Wheeler hasn't been around in 5 years. I mean, the names that pop up since 2017 are long gone, some of them. I mean, Taijuan Walker was here a hot minute for a couple of years. So when you start to look at this, you start to see the problem and where we're at now and the situation that David Stearns inherited and why right now what you saw yesterday at Citi Field and to a lesser extent, you know, in Rochester, not too far, you know, north from here, with Jonah Tong and what he did, you heard the highlight, is critically important to this era of Mets history. Because right now, the Mets have been handed a situation where Stearns took this over, where if these kids don't work out, if these kids are not the real deal in some way, shape, or form, I'm not saying they have to be DeGrom, but they have to be really good. They have to be mid to top of the rotation good. You could be staring down the barrel of another rebuild. And I mean that. And because, you know, when you look at what the Mets have had to do since Cohen took over, bringing in the Taijuan Walkers, Stearns trying to find a way to get the most out of a Sean Manaea, a Luis Severino, the wild end of the season run that Jose Quintana provided last year. I mean, there's been, and I use this term a lot from a baseball perspective, a lot of baseball magic beans and pixie dust. And look, the pitching lab and pitch shaping and taking whatever repertoire these guys have. And I said this, I said the Mets really hit on all last year. Very hard to do that. They didn't hit on Montas. I don't think Clay Holmes has been a total disaster, but you were bringing in and relying on Clay Holmes, and we've talked about this for many weeks. You're relying on Clay Holmes, a closer, to convert himself to a starter. And it takes a lot. It takes a lot. I mean, even look at Ronaldo Lopez with the Braves. Had a huge year coming out of the bullpen last year. And, he got hurt down the stretch. Now he's back. But still, you know, there's a point where the fuel isn't in the tank. Your body is now trained for a marathon instead of a sprint. And you could train it throughout an off season, but there's some development that has to go there. So you're trying to actually develop a key part of your rotation in the middle of trying to win a championship. It's very, very difficult. I mean, the top prospect that you've really seen develop since the big four guys is David Peterson, and he's done a good job. I mean, he comes in here, he's a little bit above league average pitcher. He's got a 3.90 ERA. He's a solid mid-rotation pitcher. Maybe a back rotation pitcher. Nothing wrong with that. That's a win. But then you go over and over, McGill and what the teases that he's been. Robert Gazelman, who was good for a hot minute. I'm just going down this list. Corey Oswalt never made it. I mean, there's nothing. There's nothing homegrown up and down this list. Chris Flexen. It's pretty disappointing. And there's a lot of imports. There's Kodai Senga, there's Max Scherzer, there's Marcus Stroman, Jason Vargas, Chris Bassett. I mean, maybe Jose Buto was never given a chance. He's coming out and doing pretty well out of the San Francisco bullpen. We'll see. You know, you just don't know how the guys are going to pan out. But right now, you're now looking, and this is what's really important. Last night, you saw at Citi Field a guy. Look, do I think he's going to be DeGrom or Matt Harvey? We don't know. All I know is he's got excellent stuff. It's like he's throwing a wiffle ball up there. I could not complain about anything about this guy on the mound yesterday. All right, did he get a little lucky with the comebacker up the mound that might have been a single and a couple of runs would have scored? Maybe. But he's an athlete that made an athletic play. Maybe you quibble about the command and the control. You know, lefties, it looks like he may not, you know, he may dance around, may walk lefties. That's an early review. He has a history in the minor leagues as someone who walks a few too many batters. But with that soft contact, will it get into trouble? There's going to be games. Look, he's going to walk guys. He's going to get into trouble, and he's going to give up some runs. It's going to happen to no matter how good the pitcher is. And he's a young pitcher who's going to go through this. And the thing is, he's probably going to be here the rest of the year, and you're asking him to perform at a high level when this team now really needs it. There's no cushion anymore. The Reds are right there up there with the Mets. Now, the next week of games, you could wash away a lot of the bad that's happened over the last couple of weeks, over the last couple of months. You know, Mets getting a little hot against DC and the Nats on the road. Be nice to start winning some road games consistently. They put a little cushion between them and Cincinnati. All of a sudden now things don't look so bad and you could breathe a little bit, because ultimately now, we talked about this a week ago, managing expectations. It's about just getting into October, getting to the tournament. But what you really have to start to look at here is forward, because we've talked about it. You don't have a young offense outside of Soto. Okay, Nimmo is 32. Pete Alonso, let's say he comes back, you're going to be getting ages 31 to 35. Lindor is 31. We talked about maybe there's some decline there. He's gotten hot since we talked about it, but it was actually brought up this week on X. I saw some people comparing the Baseball Savant pages year over year. McNeil is 33. So now, okay, you have the kids, the Alvarezes, the Mauricios, the Beatties, you know, so on and so forth. Okay, Vientos, maybe some of those guys emerge. They're in their early prime. But we don't know what you have there. The one that's at least stepped up to his credit since the disaster where I basically said these guys are lost. These guys don't have it. Alvarez went down, rebooted, and has come back. And unlike Beatty in a lot of ways, has played at an extremely high level. So maybe there's something there. So between Soto and Alvarez, you have some. But, you know, you have more coming. You have Benj and you have Jet Williams and maybe Ryan Clifford and so on. So there is some coming. But ultimately, the success of a franchise, and you saw it this week, I don't care how much offense you have. I don't care what closer you have. Those are important. The closer is critically important to win a championship. But if you don't have solid starting pitching, you can't go anywhere. You're a disaster team. Bad pitching teams, doesn't matter what they do. They may be entertaining. They may score some runs. They may have some fun players on their roster. They may make for some interesting runs throughout a season. In the end, they'll be bad. You want to look at what that looks like? Go back to Baseball Reference. Look at the 1996 Mets. I lived it. Bad pitching team. Bad pitching team up and down. Bullpen starters. And that's really the scary part, because that was a year where they had three young starters that was supposed to be the next thing. And none of them made it other than really Isringhausen as a closer. And it went bad quick, early and quick, and they never got out of the starting gate. Now, there was a lot of other mitigating factors that we could talk about another time. So the real thing here is that the Mets have now put a lot of eggs in the basket of Tong, of McClain. If you want to go further on this, Sproat, who I'm still not sure about, Sproat, how good he is. You want to go a little bit further? Jack Winiger, Jonathan Santucci. Maybe those guys are coming. Maybe there's somebody that we're not even talking about yet. Look, you don't have to hit on all five of them. The Mets didn't hit on Montero, but the Mets hit pretty good on Wheeler, Mats, Syndergaard, DeGrom, and Harvey. Montero was the one that didn't hit. And there were a couple others. If you go to the Mets top prospect list from, you know, 2015, 2013, I'm trying to look and see if there was anybody else over there. There was some other pitchers. I'll find it eventually. It doesn't matter anymore. But, you know, you could look at that and you could see that, you know, not everybody is going to be, Steven Matz. Yeah. You know, actually, look, Gabriel Noah. I mean, that was a guy that was on the Michael Fulmer. That was the name I was looking for. You know, Michael Fulmer actually was pretty good. They went away and went, you know, the Detroit and the Cespedes deal. He didn't make it. So you're not going to hit on all of them. So you look at some of the names out there. If you could hit on two of them, let's say right now, if you could hit on Tong and McClain, all of a sudden now, you got a different look at that rotation. Peterson gets slotted in a better way. Senga gets slotted in a better way. And then maybe you only need to bring in back-end depth. You know, yes, you're going to need depth in starting, and things of that nature. You always need about 8 to 10 pitchers, but that will work itself out potentially. There's other ways to go around that. You have to look at your core pitchers, your core rotation, because if the Mets can't figure out their own homegrown pitching, when you start to look, and we have no idea what the CBA is going to look like, when you start to look at the landscape of payroll, how much pitchers are cost, even decent pitchers are getting 20 to 25 million a year. You want to go and just wake up and be a fifth starter and give innings, you're getting 15. That I don't see changing. Elite gets 30 plus. Look at what Max Fried got. Look at what Corbin Burns got. Obviously guys like Scherzer and DeGrom and the elite. It gets expensive quick. They get hurt. You're screwed. And, you know, Stearns is in a position where he took over where he has very little to work with in terms of big league pitching. So he's got to go out there and mix and match and hope that he hits on certain guys because he doesn't want to go out and give Blake Snell or Corbin Burns a long-term contract for them to not pitch, which is what has happened this year. He can't afford that. He doesn't have a problem signing long-term a Juan Soto because there's a high chance that at his age and as an offensive player, he's going to be productive and healthy. Not so much for a pitcher. So over the next 4 or 5 weeks, I don't know what Jonah Tong, who now is at AAA, looking really good. I mean, whether you look at advanced metrics, the eye test, whatever. You know, I didn't think he has any shot. And look, I said a couple of weeks ago, I didn't think these kids were going to be the answer. And I don't think Stearns wanted them to be the answer this year. I think he wanted Blackburn to work out. I think he wanted Montas to work out. I think he wanted them just to be in the minor leagues, do what they do, give it till spring training, and then go into next year with them as options with maybe some veteran depth. But he wants to win. He doesn't want this thing to slip away because, let's be honest, it will not be acceptable, short of a catastrophic spat of injuries, which they really haven't had. They've had no more bad injuries than some other teams. I don't think I would say injuries are the reason why they're where they're at. This would go down as a very disappointing group. It's not a collapse. I can't really call it that. I know people are starting to call it that. Collapse is 07. That's the only collapse per se in Mets history. Getting beat like they did in 08 or 2022 where they still made the playoffs, those aren't collapses. They're not. So, you know, we like to overuse that term. This would go down as extremely disappointing. Now, they have six games up on a wild card with 7 to play and they lose all 7 and they lose out at the end of the year. That's a different conversation. But right now, this is not collapse. I think it is a regression to who they are. We thought this was a 95-win group. This played like a 95-win group up until the middle of June. The pitching was not good enough to sustain a 95-win group. The bullpen wasn't good enough. Let's put it this way. You want to blame the offense? The offense hasn't been as good as we'd like it to be. But the offense has been good enough that with good pitching, that we all expected them to be similar to what they did last year, especially in the second half, they should be able to win more than they have. And the pitching's been bad, real bad. And now you're at in a spot where you're relying on the development. Yes, these guys weren't drafted when Stearns was there. But go to Baseball Reference. Look at where Tong was 2 years ago in the minor leagues. Look at where McLain was 2 years ago in the minor leagues. Sproat has gone through his growing pains. They were not finished products. Perhaps what you have to give credit to is maybe some of the implementation of technology, coaching, philosophy, whatever it is, no team gives you the secret sauce, no matter how connected you are. You know, they've been able to get these guys very quickly, mind you. I mean, it's been about 2 years since McLain has been in the organization. Very quickly to the big league level and potentially to a high level at the big leagues. Not just coming in and making a spot start or giving you, some work out of the bullpen. You got to give Stearns credit on that because I know what the next thing is. It's going to be the same conversation that Alderson got. Well, Alderson won with Omar Minaya's players, Omar Minaya's drafts. And that's true. He did to a certain degree. Tommy Tanis, who's still in the organization, deserves a lot of credit. That's a good point by a subscriber on X. You know, bad job by me not to point that out. I knew that. I should have pointed it out when someone reposted something about it's Billy Epler's guys. But look, Billy Epler presided over a couple of drafts, and Billy Epler was able to execute some trades to bring in Acuna and Clifford and trade off Max Scherzer and Verlander in very tough situations. Thank you, Steve Cohen, with your checkbook. So nobody is, completely worthless in the process. And what I will find interesting is that a book is coming out next year by Andy Martino, similar to the way he wrote a book about the Yankees, about the Mets and their transition from the Wilpons to Cohen. And I bet you there'll be some interesting insights in that book that will come out. Some that you're not going to like to hear, some that'll maybe clarify some of the things that we have questions about. But yesterday, whether it be up in Rochester or in Queens at Citi Field, it was a banner day for this organization because there's a lot of hope now. And I don't know how the rest of the season pans out, and I'm sure McClain will go through his bumps, and I'm not so sure that Tong will see a big league mound this year. And, you know, we haven't even talked about Sproat. But now you really are seeing a piece of the team that for years has had to be something that at the end of the season, you had to look at the free agent list, at the trade list. Difficult to trade for these guys, too. Look at how the Mets tried to get Crochet and how expensive that package was and how they got beat out. You'd have to figure out how they'd piece together rotation. Oh, give me 6 innings, 5 innings, 3 runs, build up a bit really strong bullpen, and have enough offense to win. Sort of kind of how the 1999 Mets won, which you can win, but can you win that way every year? No, even the 1999 Mets went out and got Mike Hampton. And, you know, the last time the Mets won a pennant, you know, maybe 06, you could say they won a little bit like that. But remember, they had Pedro in that rotation before he got hurt, El Duque. These were veteran starters. But look, this has been going on. The Mets' lack of pitching development outside of the period of, you know, the Harvey, DeGrom, so on and so forth, which some of that was acquired expertly. Give Alderson, the one credit I give Alderson is how he handled R.A. Dickey in that trade. And the Beltran situation. Those two trades, to me, saved his tenure from being a disaster. But the Mets' lack of quality development of starting pitching has gone back. It's pretty much it's almost the curse of Generation K. Maybe that's what you call it. I don't know. They had the period with DeGrom and those guys, and it worked, and they almost won a championship. But they've been bad at it for 30 years. I mean, we're a long ways away from Doc and Darling and Fernandez, who was acquired. And part of that is acquiring these guys, learning and developing them. You can't just say, well, they acquired Syndergaard. You have to develop these guys. So give credit where credit is due. You have to make sure that is out there. But this is a banner day. This is maybe a turn that we haven't seen in a very, very, very long time. And I'm sorry. You know, can you win without, you know, the four aces or five aces, whatever you want to call them? You can. Teams can win that. And the game is changing now where I'm not so sure you're ever going to see Bulldogs go in 7 innings. I hope you do. I hope you do. I think if it wasn't his debut and they didn't know as much about him, I wonder if they would have tried to have McClain go a little further. I think if it wasn't 1-0 yesterday, I think he might have gotten another couple of batters. But I think the decision Mendoza made, whether it was made by him or from the front office, whatever, maybe they had him on a strict pitch count. It was the correct way. They handled him correctly. And it was about the most impressive outing debut we've seen. I mean, there was the DeGrom debut. There's the Harvey debut. Obviously, Super Tuesday with Wheeler and that day in Atlanta 12 years ago. It's been a long time since the Mets have had a young pitcher come up and make us feel like that. A really, really long time. And it was nice to see, and it's critical. And rather than just complain about where Stearns is at in terms of how he's built the rotation, look at what he was handed and the lack of development over the last decade plus, or maybe more, taking away a short period there in 2014, 2015, and know that, you know, this was where rubber meets the road in a lot of ways. And give him credit where in 2 years, you've got a couple of guys that were not coming out of the draft as shoo-in. This isn't Paul Skeens, these guys. They weren't looked at as Paul Skeens. They were developed. They had potential. They were developed. And that's something that hasn't been going on here for a long time. All right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, Pete Alonso set the Mets home run record, and now he's going to want to be paid. Should the Mets invest in Alonso? This is a conversation we're going to have over and over again. It's going to have ebbs. It's going to have flows. Possibly going to have some changes of opinion by the fan base, depending on how this season goes. But we'll talk about that right after this.
And Pete drives one to deep right center field, headed back toward the wall. It's out of here! Pete Alonso stands alone! The polar bear on his own private iceberg! Pete Alonso, the most prolific home run hitter in New York Mets history! 253 home runs, more than any Met has ever hit in the blue and orange. Pete Alonso breaks Darryl's mark.
Look at that smile. Here's Alonso, a double and a home run tonight.
And he drives this one to deep center field. Harris goes back, takes a look, and that one's out of here. Pete Alonso adds another to his record. 254, his second of the night. It's 11-5.
Turn it on, Pete.
He's getting hot. There's no telling how many home runs he'll hit in the blue and orange.
Home runs. He'll own every record.
Oh, they're calling him up for a curtain.
Nice.
Yes, sir. They love it.
All right, we're back. Hope everybody is having a great Sunday here, and hope you're enjoying this really pregame Met Talking Mets podcast here on this Sunday. And hope you're going to enjoy the Little League Classic. I wonder if it brings up some memories for you guys from your own Sandlot days. Does for me. Brought up a couple of Sandlot days. If you're interested, you know, sometimes I like to share a little bit about myself. You really want to know where Mike Silva used to play Sandlot ball. And let me tell you, I was not anything special. I had some good players. I had a couple of good players that went on to play high school and college that I played with. But we were in Brooklyn. We played Sandlot. We didn't have a lot of resources. We didn't have AAU or any kind of travel teams. But if you Google St. Athanasius Field, Brooklyn, you'll see where. And I did. And it looks almost exactly the same as it did when I was a kid, you know, with the big fence in right field and this shorter fence that goes into the schoolyard and left. And I'm looking at pictures of it, and it brings up so many memories to me of games I played there from 1989 to 1992. And then I played a little bit in Dyke Heights, Brooklyn. So some of you Brooklyn people might probably remember that for a couple of years. And then I just, by the time I was 16, I knew that sports, high school sports, wasn't going to happen for me. You know, I went to a school, same school that Chris Mullen went to, Severian High School in Brooklyn. I wasn't on any of their sports programs. So I started to get involved in listening to radio and all the things that kind of make me who I am today. I probably could have been better. And I think if I had the resources, and I think all of you could say that, a video and maybe some better coaching, maybe I could have done a little bit more, maybe get a bench role at some point if I really put time and effort and knew how to play the game. But, you know, different era, different focuses. So when you see these kids playing Little League, you know, in a lot of ways, everything that's not great about society that we talk about today, they have a lot of things that maybe we could have had some fun with back in our era. That's just my short 2 minute, you know, I guess nostalgia that comes up when I think of Sandlot, Little League, and this fun. I think baseball does a great job with this event. I don't think they market it well. I got to be honest with you. I forgot the Mets were even playing in Williamsport. Just thought it was a regular Sunday night baseball game. So should be fun. Should be interesting tonight. And really, you know, again, every game now, the Mets are in the same spot they were a year ago. Every night now, because they have no cushion, they have to bring their A game. They have to win. And they did that with a lot of unsustainable things. You know, the way the bullpen has been burnt out. You know, Diaz going two innings. Clearly, he's not available tonight. I guess Helsley will be the closer. Whether that's positive or negative, we wrote a little bit about that over at Beyond the Mic. But that's not the point. You know, the point today is about talking about McClain, talking about the pitching, talking about the importance of the pitching going forward. Now, you have these young pitchers, and let's say they come out like gangbusters, and they bring the Mets to another level, and they kind of normalize a part of the roster that's been a problem. You still have to have offense, and you have Jet Williams and Carson Benge, who I think might be the next exciting debuts. I'm not so sure we're going to see them this year. Maybe Ryan Clifford. We'll see what else, you know, the Ilian Peñas and guys like that. They're way, way, way down the line. So, Pete Alonso, as you heard, hits his Mets record home run, passes Strawberry. Here's what I'm going to say, the whole down goes straw. I'll say this real quick because I don't want to make a big part of it. I wasn't crazy about it. I didn't like it. I don't know if he wrote it or if somebody wrote it or if a marketing person wrote it. I didn't like it. But I mean, Pete is humble. Strawberry didn't have a problem with it. And let's face it, Strawberry If he had re-signed with the Mets, even if things had gone bad, he would have probably had another at least 30 home runs to his ledger and probably would have cemented himself if he had stayed on the straight and narrow path. He would have absolutely cemented himself as a all-time Met home run leader, and it would be a few more years before Pete would take over. But within relatively the same span of time in a Mets uniform, you know, Pete, you know, with a strike, the COVID season in there, Pete broke the record. So you could also argue Pete would have another 15 home runs and be well past Strawberry if he had a full season in 2020. That's not what this conversation is about. The conversation is about is the future of Pete. And I think that, you know, people have said, Mike, because I wrote about it over Beyond the Mic, I put it out on X, how I think it's time to pay the man. And I talked about how the Mets, and really the end of the Mets era, as much as they ripped the team apart in the late 80s, prior to Strawberry leaving as a free agent, was when Strawberry left to go to LA, which I've talked to Frank Cashin about. I had Daryl on my show on WGBB 20 years ago. And there's all sorts of different stories. The long and the short of it is the relationship between the Mets and Straw were toxic. I think Straw knows now he had a lot to do with that, and he probably should have handled things differently. His agent wanted him to go to LA to get more involved in other opportunities like, you know, entertainment and Hollywood and things like that. The Dodgers were where he grew up, LA, grew up home. It was, on paper, it made sense. It was a way to hurt the Mets. The Dodgers had beaten them a couple of years earlier in the postseason. But it truly was an end of an era. And then the Mets tried to bring in Bobby Bonilla and Vince Coleman. And you guys know how that went. And Bonilla gets torched a lot for being a bad Met. And his attitude stunk, particularly in 1999. And what he did was inexcusable, how he handled the media in his first tenure. But if you put together BS aside, if it was a different era of Mets history and Bonilla came in as a core offensive piece, but not the man, not expected to replace Daryl Strawberry, you'd look at him completely different. And it wouldn't be the same thing. And maybe he wouldn't have had to have the relationship with the media that he has. I mean, think about Juan Soto. Juan Soto's coming here and he's gotten some heat, but he's got Alonso and Lindor around him. And, you know, veterans like that, you know, Nimmo, to kind of insulate him a little bit, especially early on. You don't have that with the 1992 Mets. You know, but he is the guy. Eddie Murray didn't like talking to the media. You know, Dave Magadan wasn't a talkative guy. Vince Coleman, just as bad. Like, you had bad media people. They weren't doing their due diligence like they do today. So the point here is that you don't want to make a mistake. Not that they're going to be in the same spot as they were in 1992, but at this point, the Pete Alonso decision is critical. And I understand both sides of it. And again, we're having this conversation on August 17th. The Mets in the midst of a terrible two-month stretch, hanging on to a wild card. Fans are angry. They want to make the postseason. Now it looks like the best-case scenario for this 2025 club is that they get in a similar spot into the tournament, and now they're going to have to win big games on the road against teams that are really good, maybe a San Diego, maybe a Milwaukee, who knows. And, you know, they haven't shown this club, unlike the last year's club, that they could even win on the road, much less win a postseason series. So, you know, that there's a lot that comes into play between now and the end of the year when this becomes a more serious conversation. Because my feeling is, if you heard Alonso's words after, I did my part. Now, you know, if you want me, you got to pay. You don't want to pay, that's fine. I'll go somewhere else. I did my part. I set the record here in New York. He feels, based on his post-game comments, I think Alonso could put his head on the pillow and go somewhere else and know I did all I can do. I proved myself. And I understand that. And I don't think he wants to leave. I think he wants to be here. And I have a feeling that this decision is going to come down to more emotion, marketing, fan connection than it is straight analytics. And I think that ultimately is my point. And when you have an owner that could take some risks, you can do that. If you're the Tampa Bay Rays, or you're the Wilpon Mets, or you're the Oakland, Las Vegas, whatever's, you can't do that. And I understand, like, same thing with Edwin Diaz when he had that big year. The analytics people, the Keith Laws of the world, are going to come out and say, this is a bad contract, this and that. You cannot run this baseball team straight on analytics and Strat-O-Matic baseball and fantasy baseball and value equations. You have paying customers, many of which don't even care about stuff that we talk about on this show. They just want to have fun, watch baseball, and connect with people. That's ultimately why all of us get into sports. We connect emotionally with teams and people, and the numbers come after. And I think that that starts to get a little blurry as we all fancy ourselves as mini GMs and presidents of baseball operations, because we have Fangraphs now, we have Baseball Reference now, we have Baseball Savant, we have all these things that back in 1989, 1990, we didn't have. So we like players like Mookie Wilson, who quite honestly, if it was an analytics world, may not be as likable in today's game. But we liked it because it was Mookie Wilson. On the flip side, there was a lot of people that didn't like Lenny Dykstra or didn't know how good he was because we didn't have analytics to show that he was an elite run creator even when he was platooning with Mookie back in the mid-80s. So there's a couple of good pros and cons, but let's look at this with Pete from a stat standpoint and an emotional standpoint. Here's why first of all, he proved himself, and he proved himself in a big way, which changes my mind a lot. I mean, this is probably Pete's best season. And I know if you go to Baseball Reference or any other site, his rookie year was his best statistical season. And I even said, if you remember, you go back to old shows on that. I even said, and it's kind of like with DeGrom with the Cy Young when he came out and had that crazy Cy Young season. You're never going to have, and Doc Gooden talked about this when he came on my show, you're never going to maybe have the same type of season. You're always going to leave people wanting because your best season was, your first season. Now, DeGrom, it was later in his career. But once you have that season, it seems like everything always is lacking, even when it's good. Now, Pete swung far to the unacceptable where he was, at that point, starting to look a lot like Richie Sexson. We talked about that. But if you look at the Pete Alonso this year, non-juiced ball, we know that. There was a juice ball in 2019. It came out. There were plenty of fly balls that year that Pete hit that went out that when you watch them, they were like, it's like there was like a glider on them that all of a sudden just it took off. Maybe it was just circumstances of where he hit it and the weather and the time of the year. But to me, I mean, even Jeff McNeil got into the home run party later that year. The ball was juiced. You look at this year, you got to look at a guy that is now going to probably hit 35 home runs, driving well over 100 runs, 120 runs-ish, maybe 130. Maybe he breaks his own record of 131. He's hitting the ball the other way. Look at yesterday during the ballgame. Now, there was perfect positioning by Seattle, but he goes the other way with runners in scoring position. He's trying to hit more doubles. He's picking his spots to try to go for it with the home run. I think he looks like the hitter that we just have always been asking. And the only other season I think he's looked like that was 2022, which his stats are very similar. So as long as he's healthy, and as long as his approach is there, and Pete doesn't stray from who he is. And I don't know if, and I know that I've talked about it, history says when these guys hit 32, the bat slows. There's going to be some issues if the bat slows. The Mets know his health, his profile. The Mets have all the technology to understand what they're faced with here. Maybe they have technology about his health and his body that doesn't look good, and maybe they'll make a decision that way. We don't have all this information. But here's what I know. The guy, if he has an option right now, that is for $24 million. He's not taking that. Okay, he's not taking that. He made $30 million this year between his salary and his signing bonus off the bat. He made $30 million. Maybe what you do is you go out, you say, could you opt in to the 26th year at $24 million? I'll give you $30 million for an additional 3 years at $120 total. That's $144. When you take in the extra $30, that's $174. From 2025, 26, 27, 28, 29. That's 26, 27, from 2025, 26, 27, 28, 29. That's a 5-year, 170 something million dollar contract. That's a pretty good deal, Pete, for playing first base for the New York Mets. You get to stay here. You smash records here. Maybe you win a championship here. You're familiar surroundings. You can continue with your charities. He will have his number hoisted up in the rafters. He will. He has a similar type of trajectory over the next 3 or 4 years. No doubt when he retires, he gets his number hoisted up in the rafters. I really believe that. You cannot not have the all-time home run leader up in the rafters. And from an emotional standpoint, the fans love him. Look how you heard the audio on the way in. They love him. Look at how the fan fest and the turning point of the offseason with the fan fest. These things matter. Now, if he unreasonably wants a 7, 8, 9, 10-year deal, you say, hey, Pete, I can't do that. But if you want to say, hey, Pete, at the age of 29, after the 2024 season, if I offered you, you know, a 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, a five-year deal, thereabouts for $175 million, you know, he probably takes it. I'm ballparking this as we talk on the air. I'm sure that my numbers aren't perfect, but you get the point. And then next year he opts into the $24 million, so you get a little payroll relief. It accelerates a little bit. Maybe they accelerate it to a lot. You know, maybe they have a sliding scale upward where, you know, maybe it's a little bit more later on. They'll look at their payroll. I don't think the Mets like to – I think the Mets like to slide it down versus slide it up. But right now you'd like next year to lock in maybe to that. You don't know. You know, Pete's also got to think about it. You know, I'm not so sure that you're going to have a very robust offseason in free agency. You have the CBA coming. You have a lot of teams already looking. I mean, I heard Arizona wants to shed payroll. You think Colorado. You think all these teams. You know, maybe you have the Yankees, Toronto, maybe Atlanta, the Mets, Philadelphia. You know, I don't know what San Diego's situation is going to be over there. San Francisco, who has some big contracts. The Dodgers are always a threat, but they got Freddie Freeman. You know, there's a team that wants to make the next jump. Do they jump in? I don't think Pittsburgh would. You know, the Cubs have always liked Pete, but what's, you know, they've got their, you know, their own situations over there. You know, the Nats, you know, the Nats always back in the past with that team that would throw a haymaker and give a big contract. Do they want to add Pete to a mix of young players? We don't know the landscape now, but I don't think the market will be as large as you think. Not so much just because of Pete, because I just don't think teams are going to spend. I think this CBA hanging over everybody's head is going to have a lot of pause. So I think it's in both teams' best interest to work it out, because I think the Mets need to bring back a popular player, a player that has a Q rating with the fans. He's likable and he's marketable and it's sustainable. You have to have a sustainable roster of recognizable stars that recognize with the Mets so that you can build a foundation of fans for the future, so that you can have your own version of what the Yankees stole from you back in the mid-90s. And part of that was recognizable. Yes, they won championships. They're also recognizable characters that became beloved Yankees. Maybe they weren't, you know, Hall of Famers. Paul O'Neill, Tino Martinez. Not everybody was Derek Jeter on that team. There was guys who came and went that became very likable component players or surrounding stars. Maybe not components, surrounding in the core of stars. Very good players, all stars. And, you know, sometimes it's not just about, you know, finding the most efficient mix or, you know, shuttling guys in and out. I mean, quite honestly, the shuttling of pitchers this year, what, 40-something pitchers is obnoxious. And if you look at the amount of pitchers that have been shuttled in and out, most of the teams that have that level of pitchers in a season are bad teams. You look at the history of the teams that have had 42, 43 pitchers. And, you know, that's part and parcel to not having a development pipeline, but that's also why you, when you get somebody that's good, you know, you have to be responsible with this. You have to look at it way past then, oh, is he going to turn into Richie Sexton? Anybody could turn into a pumpkin. Soto could turn into a pumpkin, and then you're stuck with him for 15 years. You have to take risk. And I think if it's reasonable, and if you look at the way I've outlined how I think a contract could look, and I'm certainly not an agent, and I'm not in the front office, and I don't have the experience that these guys do, I think you could find a middle ground which gives Pete what he's always wanted since back all the way after 23 and doesn't put the Mets in a position where if things go bad, especially in 2 or 3 years, you have a lot of dead payroll. Because you have these young pitchers about to come. I don't think you want to have McClain and Tong and, you know, maybe Sproat coming into a rebuilding situation, because then they'll get expensive when it gets good. Look, 30 home run, 100 RBI don't grow on trees. I mean, Pete's fourth in home runs, what, since 2021? I mean, Schwarber's going to get paid, and, you know, he's 32 years old. He's a free agent. He's going to get paid. He's got, you know, about 20 home runs more than Pete. You know, maybe Pete becomes more of a DH later on, but, I mean, that's the other thing we're not even talking about. And that's a key point. He's incredible at first base on scoops. To me, there's nobody better. What, Matt Olson may be there? There's nobody better. That is invaluable. I'm just going to challenge you. Next time you watch a game, count how many errors he saves. I counted about 2 or 3 yesterday. Now, there's always debatable about it. 2 or 3. I'm guarantee you the Mets would have had a couple of errors yesterday if Mark Vientos was at first base. Trust me. That's not a knock on Vientos. Nobody's as good as Pete. Statistically, they track that now. So that's where you're at. So that's how I, you know, my feelings on Pete Alonso. Obviously, big day. The big news was Nolan McClain Jonah Tong up in Rochester playing for the Syracuse Mets. And, you know, are more on the way. And maybe there's hope. I think yesterday is the first time in a while we've not only seen hope for this year, but more importantly, this is way bigger than just making the playoffs this year. This is about having a more sustainable, better foundation to be able to compete and win in subsequent years. The Mets need to have more their own starting pitching, cost-controlled, high upside starting pitching, so they could play around with starters 4, 5, 6, instead of playing around with starters 1, 2, and 3, or 2 and 3, with free agency and, you know, guys with upside. Like, you could do that. You still have to do that, but you're not going to hit on all those guys. And to be upset that the Mets didn't hit 2 years in a row perfectly, that's like expecting to, you know, have 21 consistently at the blackjack table. You just don't happen. The odds are against it. You try, no matter how smart you are, how many resources you are, how many, you know, pitch shaping tools you have and data analysts and blah, blah, blah. You just, it's hard. You know, these are human beings that potentially can't execute no matter what the data says. There's a lot of other factors in there. So, all right, that's it. That's all I have. Of course, I want everybody to enjoy tonight's classic on ESPN. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X at TalkingMetsNoG and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. NoG, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. You can get me on Instagram, TalkingMetsNoG. And I'd love for you to become a premium subscriber at the newsletter, substack.com/@TalkingMetsNoG. Less than a cup of coffee a month. Love for you to join this growing community. Until next time, take care, everybody. We'll be right back.